Greenhouse gases. Armstrong told me he made the no-change forecast because he did not think there were good Bayesian priors for any alternative assumption. The no-change forecast, he has found, has been a good default in the other areas that he has studied. This would be a more persuasive case if he had applied the same rigor to climate forecasting that he had to other areas he has studied. Instead, as Armstrong told a congressional panel in 2011, "I actually try not to learn a lot about climate change. I am the forecasting guy." This book advises you to be wary of forecasters who say that the science is not very important to their jobs, or scientists who say that forecasting is not very important to their jobs. These activities are essential and intimately related. A forecaster who says he doesn't care about the science is like the cook who says he doesn't care about food. What distinguishes science and what makes a forecast scientific is that it is concerned with the objective world. What makes forecasts fail is when our concern only extends as far as the method, maxim, or model. An inconvenient truth about the temperature record. But if Armstrong's critique is so off the mark, what should we make of his proposed bet with Gore? It has not been a failed forecast at all. On the contrary, it has gone quite successfully. Since Armstrong made the bet in 2007, temperatures have varied considerably from month to month, but not in any consistent pattern. 2011 was a slightly cooler year than 2007, for instance. And this has been true for longer than 4 years. One inconvenient truth is that global temperatures did not increase at all in the decade between 2001 and 2011. In fact, they declined, although imperceptibly. This type of framing can sometimes be made in bad faith. For instance, if you set the year 1998 as your starting point, which had record high temperatures associated with the ENSO cycle, it will be easier to identify a cooling trend. Conversely, the decadal trend from 2008 through 2018 will very probably be toward warming once it is calculated, since 2008 was a relatively cool year. Statistics of this sort are akin to when the stadium scoreboard optimistically mentions that the shortstop has 8 hits in his last 19 at-bats against left-handed relief pitchers, ignoring the fact that he is batting 190 for the season. Yet global warming does not progress at a steady pace. Instead, the history of temperature rise is one of a clear long-term increase punctuated by periods of sideways or even negative trends. In addition to the decade between 2001 and 2011, for instance, there would have been little sign of warming between 1894 and 1913, or 1937 and 1956, or 1966 and 1977, even though CO2 concentrations were increasing all the while. This problem bears some resemblance to that faced by financial analysts. Over the very long run, the stock market essentially always moves upward. But this tells you almost nothing about how it will behave in the next day, week, or year. It might be possible to explain some of the recent sideways trend directly from the science. Increased sulfur emissions in China may have played some role, for instance. And it might be remembered that although temperatures did not rise from 2001 through 2011, they were still much warmer than in any prior decade. Nevertheless, this book encourages readers to think carefully about the signal and the noise, and to seek out forecasts that couch their predictions in percentage or probabilistic terms. They are a more honest representation of the limits of our predictive abilities. When a prediction about a complex phenomenon is expressed with a great deal of confidence, it may be a sign that the forecaster has not thought through the problem carefully, has overfit his statistical model, or is more interested in making a name for himself than in getting at the truth. Neither Armstrong nor Schmidt was willing to hedge very much on their predictions about the temperature trend. "We did some simulations from 1850 up to 2007," Armstrong told me. "When we looked 100 years ahead, it was virtually certain that I would win that bet." Schmidt, meanwhile, was willing to offer attractive odds to anyone betting against his position that temperatures would continue to increase. I could easily give you odds on the next decade being warmer than this decade, he told me. You want 100-to-1 odds? I'd give it to you. The statistical forecasting methods that I outlined earlier can be used to resolve the dispute, and they suggest that neither Armstrong nor Schmidt has it quite right. If you measure the temperature trend one decade at a time, it registers a warming trend about 75% of the time since 1900, but a cooling trend the other 25% of the time. As the growth rate of atmospheric CO2 increases, creating a stronger greenhouse signal, periods of flat or cooling temperatures should become less frequent. Nevertheless, they are not impossible, nor are the odds anything like 100-to-1 against them. Instead, if you assume that CO2 levels will increase at the current pace of about 2 ppm per year, the chance that there would be no net warming over the course of a given decade would be about 15%, according to this method. Yet another reason why estimating uncertainty is essential. Uncertainty is an essential and non-negotiable part of a forecast. As we have found, sometimes an honest and accurate expression of the uncertainty is what has the potential to save property and lives. In other cases, as when trading stock options or wagering on an NBA team, you may be able to place bets on your ability to forecast the uncertainty accurately. However, there is another reason to quantify the uncertainty carefully and explicitly. It is essential to scientific progress, especially under Bayes' theorem. Suppose that in 2001, you had started out with a strong prior belief in the hypothesis that industrial carbon emissions would continue to cause a temperature rise. In my view, such a belief is appropriate because of our strong causal understanding of the greenhouse effect and the empirical evidence for it up to that point. Say you had attributed the chance of the global warming hypothesis being true at 95%. But then you observe some new evidence. Over the next decade, from 2001 through 2011, global temperatures do not rise. In fact, they fall, although very slightly. Under Bayes' theorem, you should revise your estimate of the probability of the global warming hypothesis downward. The question is, by how much? If you had come to a proper estimate of the uncertainty in near-term temperature patterns, the downward revision would not be terribly steep. As we found, there is about a 15% chance that there will be no net warming over a decade, even if the global warming hypothesis is true, because of the variability in the climate. Conversely, if temperature changes are purely random and unpredictable, the chance of a cooling decade would be 50%. Since an increase and a decrease in temperatures are equally likely. Under Bayes' theorem, a no-net warming decade would cause you to revise downward your estimate of the global warming hypothesis likelihood to 85% from 95%. On the other hand, if you had asserted that there was just a 1% chance that temperatures would fail to increase over the decade, your theory is now in much worse shape because you are claiming that this was a more definitive test. Under Bayes' theorem, the probability you would attach to the global warming hypothesis has now dropped to just 28%. When we advance more confident claims, and they fail to come to fruition, this constitutes much more powerful evidence against our hypothesis. We can't really blame anyone for losing faith in our forecasts when this occurs. They are making the correct inference under Bayesian logic. So what is the incentive to make more confident claims to begin with, especially when they are not really justified by the statistical evidence? There are all sorts of reasons that people may do this in practice. In the climate debate, it may be because these more confident claims can seem more persuasive, and they may be, but only if they are right. Attributing every weather anomaly to man-made climate change, other than the higher temperatures the global warming phenomenon is named for, it's a high-stakes gamble, rooted more in politics than in science. There is little consensus about the ways that climate change might manifest itself other than through temperature increases and probably rising sea levels. Obviously, charging that every snowfall is evidence against the theory is just as ridiculous. We're in a street fight with these people. The fundamental dilemma faced by climatologists is that global warming is a long-term problem that might require a near-term solution. Because carbon dioxide remains in the atmosphere for so long, decisions that we make about it today will affect the lives of future generations. In a perfectly rational and benevolent world, this might not be so worrying. But our political and cultural institutions are not so well devised to handle these problems, not when the United States Congress faces re-election every 2 years, and when businesses are under pressure to meet earnings forecasts every quarter. Climate scientists have reacted to this challenge in a variety of ways, some involving themselves more in the political debate, and others keeping it at arm's length. Michael Mann, who is director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University, was once at the center of a controversy. ClimateGate concerned the hacking of a server at the Climate Research Unit, CRU, at the University of East Anglia, which produces the temperature record that the UK's Met Office uses. Skeptics alleged that Mann and other scientists had conspired to manipulate the CRU's temperature record. The pertinent facts are that the scientists were cleared of wrongdoing by a panel of their peers, and that the CRU's temperature record is quite consistent with the others. But Mann and other scientists in the hacked emails demonstrated a clear concern with the public relations elements of how the science would be perceived. Mann is happy to tell you as much. I met with him on a crisp fall afternoon at his office at Penn State, where we chatted for about 2 hours. Mann is exceptionally thoughtful about the science behind global warming. Like most other climatologists, he has little doubt about the theoretical mechanisms behind climate change, but he takes a skeptical view toward the predictions rendered by climate models. Any honest assessment of the science is going to recognize that there are things we understand pretty darn well and things we sort of know, he told me. But there are things that are uncertain, and there are things we just have no idea about whatsoever. In my mind, one of the unfortunate consequences of this bad faith public conversation we've been having is that we're wasting our time debating a proposition that is very much accepted within the scientific community, when we could be having a good faith discussion about the uncertainties that do exist. But Mann, who blogs along with Schmidt at realclimate.org, sees himself as engaged in trench warfare against groups like the Heartland Institute. "We're in a street fight with these people," he told me, referring to a Nature editorial that employed the phrase. The long-term goal of the street fight is to persuade the public and policymakers about the urgency, or lack thereof, of action to combat climate change. In a society accustomed to overconfident forecasters who mistake the confidence they express in a forecast for its veracity, expressions of uncertainty are not seen as a winning strategy by either side. Where you have to draw the line is to be very clear about where the uncertainties are, but to not have our statements be so laden in uncertainty that no one ever listens to what we're saying, Mann told me. It would be irresponsible for us as a community to not be speaking out. There are others who are happy to fill the void, and they're going to fill the void with disinformation. The difference between science and politics. In practice, Mann's street fight is between consensus websites like realclimate.org and skeptical ones like What's Up With That, and revolves around day-to-day scuffles about the latest journal article or weather pattern or political controversy. Both sides almost invariably stick up for others in their circle and refuse to yield ground. When you're a jet all the way. I do not mean to suggest that the territory occupied by the two sides is symmetrical. In the scientific argument over global warming, the truth seems to be mostly on one side. The greenhouse effect almost certainly exists and will be exacerbated by man-made CO2 emissions. This is very likely to make the planet warmer. The impacts of this are uncertain, but are weighted toward unfavorable outcomes. The street fighter mentality, nevertheless, seems to be predicated on the notion that we are just on the verge of resolving our political problems, if only a few more people could be persuaded about the science. In fact, we are probably many years away. There's a point when I come to the conclusion that we're going to have to figure out how to take the carbon out, Richard Rood told me in Copenhagen. anticipating that there was almost no way the 193 members of the United Nations would agree to mutually acceptable terms. Meanwhile, the American public's confidence that global warming is occurring has decreased somewhat over the past several years. And even if there were 100% agreement on the effects of climate change, some states and some countries would make out better than others in any plan to mitigate carbon emissions. We have some very progressive Democratic governors in coal states, I was told by the governor of Washington, Christine Gregoire. Boy, are they nervous about all this. I don't know how to resolve these problems, which are not unique to the climate debate. What I do know is that there is a fundamental difference between science and politics. In fact, I've come to view them more and more as opposites. In science, progress is possible. In fact, if one believes in Bayes' theorem, scientific progress is inevitable as predictions are made and as beliefs are tested and refined. The march towards scientific progress is not always straightforward, and some well-regarded, even consensus theories are later proved wrong. But either way, science tends to move toward the truth. In politics, by contrast, we seem to be growing ever further away from consensus. The amount of polarization between the two parties in the United States House, which had narrowed from the New Deal through the 1970s, had grown by 2011 to be the worst that it had been in at least a century. Republicans have moved especially far away from the center, although Democrats have to some extent too. In science, one rarely sees all the data point toward one precise conclusion. Real data is noisy. Even if the theory is perfect, the strength of the signal will vary. And under Bayes' theorem, no theory is perfect. Rather, it is a work in progress, always subject to further refinement and testing. This is what scientific skepticism is all about. In politics, one is expected to give no quarter to his opponents. It is seen as a gaffe when one says something inconvenient and true. Partisans are expected to show equal conviction about a set of beliefs on a range of economic, social, and foreign policy issues that have little intrinsic relation to one another. As far as approximations of the world go, the platforms of the Democratic and Republican parties are about as crude as it gets. It is precisely because the debate may continue for decades that climate scientists might do better to withdraw from the street fight and avoid crossing the Rubicon from science into politics. In science, dubious forecasts are more likely to be exposed, and the truth is more likely to prevail. In politics, a domain in which the truth enjoys no privileged status, it's anybody's guess. The dysfunctional state of the American political system is the best reason to be pessimistic about our country's future. Our scientific and technological prowess is the best reason to be optimistic. We are an inventive people. The United States produces ridiculous numbers of patents, as many of the world's best universities and research institutions, and our companies lead the market in fields ranging from pharmaceuticals to information technology. If I had a choice between a tournament of ideas and a political cage match, I know which fight I'd rather be engaging in, especially if I thought I had the right forecast. Chapter 13. What you don't know can hurt you. Franklin Delano Roosevelt said December 7th would live in infamy. The bombing of Pearl Harbor in 1941, the first foreign attack on American soil in more than a century, was as shocking to the American psyche as the destruction of the World Trade Center 60 years later. And it transformed a vaguely menacing antagonist on the other side of the planet into a terrifying, palpable, existential threat. And yet, the attack on Pearl Harbor seemed quite predictable after the fact. Many signals suggested an attack on Pearl Harbor was possible, and perhaps imminent. Diplomatic relations between the United States and Japan were in a state of rapid deterioration in November and December 1941. The Japanese desire for territorial expansion made the U.S. Pacific Fleet, which Roosevelt had moved to Pearl Harbor from San Diego precisely to deter such ambitions, a natural flashpoint. Meanwhile, Japan's navy was repeatedly changing its call signs, an indication that its intentions were becoming more hostile. And there was increasing movement of Japanese troops and warships off the coasts of China and Southeast Asia. The most ominous signal of all was the silence. American intelligence officials had ingeniously succeeded in breaking PURPLE, the code that Japan used to encrypt its diplomatic messages, allowing us to decipher perhaps 97% of them. Our attempts to decode Japanese military transmissions were less successful. But even if we could not understand the messages, we heard them and could trace their location. A steady stream of click-clacks from Japan's fleet of aircraft carriers ordinarily betrayed their whereabouts when they were out to sea. From mid-November onward, however, there had been total radio silence. We had no idea where their carriers were. There were no global satellites in the 1940s, and only the primitive makings of radar. Air patrol reconnaissance missions were cost prohibitive in the vast reaches of the Pacific and were carried out erratically at a distance of only 300 or 400 miles from the base. The radio transmissions were our best means of detection. Without them, an entire fleet of these ships, each of them the size of 6 football fields, had disappeared. Many in the intelligence community concluded that the carriers were close to their home waters, where they could rely on alternate means of communication. The second possibility was that the fleet had ventured far into the Pacific, away from American naval installations. The Japanese carrier fleet, in fact, was en route to Hawaii. It had charted a precise course. Like a quarterback perceiving the holes in his opponent's coverage, the fleet was maneuvering through the blind spots in our defenses. The ships initially traveled in a long straight line toward the east-southeast, almost exactly bisecting our naval stations at the Midway Islands and in Dutch Harbor, Alaska. Then on December 4th, after reaching longitude 165 west, they abruptly turned at a 45-degree angle toward Hawaii, where 3 days later they would launch the morning attack that killed almost 2,400 soldiers and sank 4 of the Navy's battleships. The United States Congress declared war on Japan and its entry into World War II by a vote of 470-1 the next day. Signals signifying nothing. When American Airlines Flight 77 collided with the limestone face of the Pentagon on September 11, 2001, killing 59 innocent passengers and 125 of his colleagues, Donald Rumsfeld thought about Pearl Harbor. He was 8 years old on December 7, 1941, and was listening to his beloved Chicago Bears on the radio when the broadcast was interrupted by a bulletin with news of the surprise attack. I met Rumsfeld at his office in Washington in March 2012, having been warned that interviews with him could be hit or miss. Rumsfeld, at 5'7" and almost 80 years old, is not tremendously physically imposing, but he is intimidating in almost every other way. Born in Evanston, Illinois, he attended public high school and received an academic scholarship to Princeton, where he starred on the wrestling team and wrote his thesis on presidential powers before going off to serve in the Navy and then in Congress. His office walls are adorned with plaques and memorabilia from the 4 administrations he has served. He is the only person in American history to have had 2 separate stints as Secretary of Defense, first under President Ford from 1975 to 1977, and then, fully a quarter century later, under George W. Bush. But Rumsfeld was in a good mood, having scrutinized the detailed outline for this book that I had given to his young and able chief of staff, Keith Urban. I knew of Rumsfeld's interest in Pearl Harbor. He greeted me with a photocopy of the foreword to a remarkable book, Roberta Wallstetter's 1962 Pearl Harbor, Warning and Decision, which outlined the myriad reasons why the Japanese attack had been such a surprise to our military and intelligence officers. Worse than being unprepared, we had mistaken our ignorance for knowledge and made ourselves more vulnerable as a result. In Pearl Harbor, what they prepared for were things that really didn't happen, Rumsfeld said. They prepared for sabotage because they had so many Japanese descendants living in Hawaii. And so they stuck all the airplanes close together so they could be protected. So, of course, the bombers came and they were enormously vulnerable, and they were destroyed. In advance of Pearl Harbor, as Rumsfeld mentioned, we had a theory that sabotage, attack from within, was the most likely means by which our planes and ships would be attacked. the concern over sabotage was pervasive in Hawaii. It was thought that the 80,000 Japanese nationals there might attack not just military bases, but radio stations, pineapple farms, and dairy mills with little warning. Any signals were interpreted in this context, logically or not, and we prepared for subterfuge. We stacked our planes wingtip to wingtip and our ships stern to bow, on the theory that it would be easier to monitor one big target than several smaller ones. Meanwhile, we theorized that if Japan seemed to be mobilizing for an attack, it would be against Russia or perhaps against the Asian territorial possessions of the United Kingdom, Russia and the UK being countries that were already involved in the war. Why would the Japanese want to provoke the sleeping giant of the United States? We did not see that Japan believed our involvement in the war was inevitable, and they wanted to strike us when we were least prepared and they could cause the most damage to our navy. The Imperial Japanese government of the time was not willing to abandon its hopes for territorial expansion. We had not seen the conflict through the enemy's eyes. To Wallstetter, a signal is a piece of evidence that tells us something useful about our enemy's intentions. This book thinks of a signal as an indication of the underlying truth behind a statistical or predictive problem. Wallstetter's definition of noise is subtly different too. Whereas I tend to use noise to mean random patterns that might easily be mistaken for signals, Wallstetter uses it to mean the sound produced by competing signals. In the field of intelligence analysis, the absence of signals can signify something important. The absence of radio transmissions from Japan's carrier fleet signaled their move toward Hawaii. And the presence of too many signals can make it exceptionally challenging to discern meaning. They may drown one another out in an ear-splitting cacophony. Imagine a set of diagrams that consist of a series of 10 signals, each governed by an extremely simple and orderly mathematical function known as a sine wave. Imagine further that one of these signals is highlighted and is much more distinct than the others. After the fact of an attack or some other failure of prediction, this is how the world may look to us. We will see the signal, the paper trail, the pattern, the precursors. Following both Pearl Harbor and September 11th, a significant minority of Americans asserted that the patterns were so clear that the government must have known about the attack, and therefore must have been complicit in planning or executing it. But this is not usually how the patterns look to us in advance. Instead, they are more like an ugly mess of tangled spaghetti string. As Wallstetter writes, it is much easier after the event to sort the relevant from the irrelevant signals. After the event, of course, a signal is always crystal clear. We can now see what disaster it was signaling, since the disaster has occurred. But before the event, it is obscure and pregnant with conflicting meanings. It comes to the observer embedded in an atmosphere of noise, i.e., in the company of all sorts of information that is useless and irrelevant for predicting the particular disaster. In cases like these, what matters is not our signal detection capabilities. Provided that we have met some basic threshold of competence, we will have perceived plenty of signals before something on the scale of Pearl Harbor or September 11th. The relevant signals will be somewhere in a file cabinet or a computer database, but so will a whole host of irrelevant ones. We need signal analysis capabilities to isolate the pertinent signals from the echo chamber. Usually, we will have some views on which signals are more important and require our focus. It is good and necessary to have these views up to a point. I've detailed the problems that ensue when we consider data without context. Rather than make useful predictions, we trip out on the patterns and get nowhere fast. However, the context we provide can be biased and self-serving. As Cicero warned Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, men may construe things after their fashion, clean from the purpose of the things themselves. We may focus on those signals which advance our preferred theory about the world, or might imply a more optimistic outcome. Or we may simply focus on the ones that fit with bureaucratic protocol, like the doctrine that sabotage rather than an air attack was the more likely threat to Pearl Harbor. The unfamiliar and the improbable. Rumsfeld's favorite part of Wolfstetter's book is the foreword, composed by the Nobel Prize-winning economist Thomas Schelling, who was instrumental in translating John Nash's early work on game theory into national security contexts. Schelling writes of our propensity to mistake the unfamiliar for the improbable. There is a tendency in our planning to confuse the unfamiliar with the improbable. The contingency we have not considered seriously looks strange. What looks strange is thought improbable. What is improbable need not be considered seriously. Because of the United States' isolation from the European and Asian continents and the relatively good relations we have maintained with the rest of the Americas since the promulgation of the Monroe Doctrine, we have infrequently been the subject of foreign attack. The exceptions, September 11th and near misses, the Cuban Missile Crisis, have therefore been exceptionally jarring to us. Before Pearl Harbor, the last foreign attack on American soil had been during the War of 1812. Americans just do not live among the ruins of wars past, as people in Europe and Asia have throughout their history. But our Hawaiian territory sat in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. Honolulu is closer to Tokyo, 3,860 miles, than to Washington, D.C., 4,825 miles. Because of its geographic position and the presence of our naval fleet, it made an obvious target to the Japanese. The unfamiliarity of attacks on American territory may have made us complacent about the threat. Perhaps we went through a logical deduction something along these lines. 1. United States is rarely attacked. 2. Hawaii is part of the United States. 3. Therefore, Hawaii is unlikely to be attacked. This is deeply flawed thinking. As I described in Chapter 1, our predictions often fail when we venture out of sample. The fact that the United States had rarely been attacked is an empirical observation, not an iron law. That Nebraska, say, had never been attacked by a foreign power gave no real evidentiary weight to the situation in Hawaii, given the latter's outlying geographic position in the Pacific and the precariousness of the war situation there. But at least this flawed type of thinking would have involved some thinking. If we had gone through the thought process, perhaps we could have recognized how loose our assumptions were. Schelling suggests that our problems instead run deeper. When a possibility is unfamiliar to us, we do not even think about it. Instead, we develop a sort of mind blindness to it. In medicine, this is called anosognosia. Part of the physiology of the condition prevents a patient from recognizing that they have the condition. Some Alzheimer's patients present in this way. The predictive version of this syndrome requires us to do one of the things that goes most against our nature. Admit to what we do not know. Was 9/11 a known unknown? There are known knowns. These are things we know. We also know there are known unknowns. That is to say, we know there are some things we do not know. But there are also unknown unknowns. There are things we do not know we don't know. Donald Rumsfeld. Rumsfeld's famous line about unknown unknowns, delivered in a 2002 press conference in response to a reporter's question about the presence of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, is a corollary to Schelling's concern about mistaking the unfamiliar for the unlikely. If we ask ourselves a question and can come up with an exact answer, that is a known known. If we ask ourselves a question and can't come up with a very precise answer, that is a known unknown. An unknown unknown is when we haven't really thought to ask the question in the first place. They are gaps in our knowledge, but gaps that we don't know exist, Rumsfeld writes in his 2011 memoir. The concept of the unknown unknown is sometimes misunderstood. It's common to see the term employed in formulations like this to refer to a fairly specific but hard to predict threat. Nigeria is a good bet for a crisis in the not too distant future. An unknown unknown that poses the most profound implications for U.S. and global security. This particular prophecy about the terrorist threat posed by Nigeria was rather prescient. It was written in 2006, 3 years before the Nigerian national Umar Farouk Abu Mutalib tried to detonate explosives hidden in his underwear while aboard a flight from Amsterdam to Detroit. However, it got the semantics wrong. Anytime you are able to enumerate a dangerous or unpredictable element, you are expressing a known unknown. To articulate what you don't know is a mark of progress. Few things, as we have found, fall squarely into the binary categories of the predictable and the unpredictable. Even if you don't know to predict something with 100% certainty, you may be able to come up with an estimate or a forecast of the threat. It may be a sharp estimate or a crude one, an accurate forecast or an inaccurate one, a smart one or a dumb one. But at least you are alert to the problem, and you can usually get somewhere. We don't know exactly how much of a terrorist threat Nigeria may pose to us, for instance, but it is probably a bigger threat than Luxembourg. The problem comes when, out of frustration that our knowledge of the world is imperfect, we fail to make a forecast at all. An unknown unknown is a contingency that we have not even considered. We have some kind of mental block against it, or our experience is inadequate to imagine it. It's as though it doesn't even exist. This poses especially grave risks when we consider the signals we receive from terrorists. As before Pearl Harbor, there were many signals that pointed toward the September 11th attacks. There had been at least a dozen warnings about the potential for aircraft to be used as weapons, including a 1994 threat by Algerian terrorists to crash a hijacked jet into the Eiffel Tower, and a 1998 plot by a group linked to Al-Qaeda to crash an explosives-laden airplane into the World Trade Center. The World Trade Center had been targeted by terrorists before. The 1993 bombings by Ramzi Youssef and his co-conspirators, who had trained at Al-Qaeda camps in Afghanistan, had killed six and were intended to bring the Twin Towers down. Al-Qaeda was known to be an exceptionally dangerous and inventive terrorist organization. It had a propensity for pulling off large-scale attacks, including the bombing of U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania in 1998, which killed 224, and the bombing of the USS Cole in Yemen in 2000. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice had been warned in July 2001 about heightened Al-Qaeda activity, and that the group was shifting its focus from foreign targets to the United States itself. "It's my sixth sense," CIA Chief George Tenet had said after seeing the intelligence. "But I feel it coming. This is going to be the big one." An Islamic fundamentalist named Zacharias Moussaoui had been arrested on August 16, 2001, less than a month before the attacks, after an instructor at a flight training school in Minnesota reported he was behaving suspiciously. Moussaoui, despite having barely more than 50 hours of training and having never flown solo, had sought training in a Boeing 747 simulator, an unusual request for someone who was nowhere near obtaining his pilot's license. It is much easier to identify the importance of these signals after the fact. Our national security agencies have to sort through literally tens of thousands or even hundreds of thousands of potential warnings to find useful nuggets of information. Most of them amount to nothing. Still, the September 11th plot was exceptionally ambitious, and the terrorists were able to execute it with relatively few hitches. 19 terrorists had entered the air transit system, successfully hijacking four planes. Three of the four planes hit their targets. United 93 failed to do so only because of the exceptional bravery of the passengers on board, who charged the cockpit after they learned what had happened to the other flights. Not only had we failed to detect the plot, but it doesn't appear that we came all that close to doing so. The 9/11 Commission report identified four types of systemic failures that contributed to our inability to appreciate the importance of these signals, including failures of policy, capabilities, and management. The most important category was failures of imagination. The signals just weren't consistent with our familiar hypotheses about how terrorists behaved, and they went in one ear and out the other without our really registering them. The North American Aerospace Defense Command, NORAD, had actually proposed running a war game in which a hijacked airliner crashed into the Pentagon. But the idea was dismissed as being too unrealistic. and in the unlikely event that such an attack were to occur, it was assumed the plane would come from overseas and not from one of our domestic airports. Ironically, this was the exact opposite of the mistake that we'd made before Pearl Harbor, where the possibility of an attack from abroad was dismissed because planners were concerned about sabotage. The possibility of a suicide attack may also have been hard to imagine. FAA policy was predicated on the idea that a hijacking would result in a tense standoff and perhaps a detour to some exotic airport in the Middle East. But it was assumed the terrorist would not want to destroy the plane or to kill passengers other than as a negotiation tactic. Thus, cockpit doors were not tightly sealed and were often left entirely unlocked in practice. Yet suicide attacks had a rich history, including, of course, the Japanese kamikaze pilots in World War II. Moreover, suicide attacks had become much more common in the years immediately preceding September 11th. One database of terrorist incidents documented 39 of them in 2000 alone, including the bombing of the USS Cole in Yemen, up from 31 in the 1980s. However, World War II was a distant memory, and most of the suicide attacks had occurred in the Middle East or in Third World countries. The mental shortcut that Daniel Kahneman calls the availability heuristic. We tend to overrate the likelihood of events that are nearer to us in time and space and underpredict the ones that aren't. May have clouded our judgment. You can reasonably predict behavior if people would prefer not to die, Rumsfeld told me. But if people are just as happy dying or feel that it's a privilege or that it achieves their goal, then they're going to behave in a very different way. The scale of September 11th. The September 11th plot, then, was less a hypothesis that we evaluated and rejected as being unlikely, and more one that we had failed to really consider in the first place. It was too unfamiliar to us. Rumsfeld suggested in his memoir that September 11th was an unknown unknown. The CIA would tell you that it was not a thought that was completely foreign to them, he told me. But a lot of it came after the attack, in retrospect. I mean, it's fair to say Al-Qaeda was a known unknown, added Urban, Rumsfeld's chief of staff. But one of the things Tenet talks about in his book is that the scale was far different than any other attack. The fact that it was so big. Indeed, the sheer magnitude of the September 11th attack, 2,977 innocent people killed, most differentiated it from our previous experience with terrorism. Even those who were the most concerned about what Al-Qaeda was planning, like Tenet and Richard Clark, the chairman of counterterrorism at the National Security Council, had trouble conceiving of its scale. The notes that Clark had sent to Condoleezza Rice, for instance, implored her to imagine what might happen if hundreds of Americans died, not thousands of Americans as actually occurred. Prior to September 11th, the largest terror attack in a Western country had been only about one-tenth as fatal, when in 1985 a Sikh extremist group hit a bomb in an Air India flight bound for Delhi from Montreal, killing 329 passengers. The destruction of Oklahoma City's Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building by the militant Timothy McVeigh in 1995, which killed 168, had been the largest attack on American soil. But September 11th was not an outlier. Although the particulars of the events that day were not discerned in advance, and although they may have been very hard to predict, we had some reason to think that an attack on the scale of September 11th was possible. The mathematics of terrorism. Why 9/11 wasn't an outlier. It might seem uncomfortable to think about terrorism in an abstract and mathematical fashion, as we are about to do here. To be clear, this is not a substitute for the sort of signal analysis that the intelligence community performs. But this type of thinking can help patch some of our blind spots and give us better estimates of the overall hazard that terrorism poses. We can better appreciate future risk if we analyze the existing data. In 2008, I was invited to speak at a conference hosted by the Center for Strategic and International Studies, CSIS, a Washington-based foreign policy think tank. The timing couldn't have been much worse. It was just 2 weeks before the 2008 elections. but I was told that the panel involved national security, and I suppose I felt it was my duty to attend. The conference gathered experts from different domains in the hope that a group brainstorming session might stumble across one or two outside-the-box insights about how to predict and prevent terror attacks. There was a marketing executive from Coca-Cola on the panel, a police detective from New York, a man who created algorithms for the dating website eHarmony, and me. There were also a number of experts whose work was more self-evidently related to terrorism, people who worked for the State Department or the military or the defense contractors around Washington, D.C. I gave a short presentation describing my work predicting outcomes in baseball and in politics. It was received politely enough, but then it was time for the question and answer session. "That's all very nice, Nate," I was told, "but how in the hell is this applicable to terrorism?" I'm paraphrasing, but only slightly. Frankly, the methods I presented at the conference probably weren't all that useful for national security analysis. Baseball and politics are data-rich fields that yield satisfying answers. Thousands of baseball games are played every year. Elections occur less frequently and require somewhat more caution to forecast. But there are hundreds of polls released during every presidential campaign. All this data is publicly available, freely or cheaply. Terrorism, seemingly, is not this way at all. The events that we are really concerned about, like September 11th, occur only rarely. Moreover, terrorist groups try to conceal their intentions. Al-Qaeda was known to be especially effective at this. Within the realm of terrorism, just as was the case immediately before Pearl Harbor, the absence of signals is sometimes more worrisome than the presence of them. If the CIA is able to hack into an internet chat site thought to be used by radical groups, there may be quite a bit of loose and casual chatter at first, when organizations like Al-Qaeda are simply hoping to find new and naive recruits. But when an attack is being plotted and the stakes are raised, the conversation usually goes offline. At a microscopic level, then, at the level of individual terrorists or individual terror schemes, there are unlikely to be any magic bullet solutions to predicting attacks. Instead, intelligence requires sorting through the spaghetti strands of signals that I spoke about earlier. One expert I talked to at the CSIS conference provided another metaphor. Detecting a terror plot is much more difficult than finding a needle in a haystack, he said, and more analogous to finding one particular needle in a pile full of needle parts. Some problems that are highly unpredictable on a case-by-case basis may seem more orderly if we zoom out and take a macroscopic view. Outside insight into the mathematical properties of terrorism has proved more useful here. Aaron Clausette, a professor at the University of Colorado with a background in physics and computer science, has published papers on the mathematics of everything from the evolution of whales to the network dynamics of multiplayer role-playing games. The intelligence community has a long-standing reputation for preferring alpha male types. The 30-something Clausette, whose Catholic research interests might seem geeky to it, has met a mixture of encouragement and resistance when presenting his findings. "Some people say it's a breath of fresh air," Clausette told me when we caught up on the phone. "That's a few people. Most people look at it and say, that's kind of weird. You want to use math?" Clausette's insight, however, is actually quite simple, or at least it seems that way with the benefit of hindsight. What his work found is that the mathematics of terrorism resemble those of another domain discussed in this book, earthquakes. Imagine that you live in a seismically active area like California. Over a period of a couple of decades, you experience magnitude 4 earthquakes on a regular basis, magnitude 5 earthquakes perhaps a few times a year, and a handful of magnitude 6s. If you have a house that can withstand a magnitude 6 earthquake, but not a magnitude 7, would it be right to conclude that you have nothing to worry about? Of course not. According to the power law distribution that these earthquakes obey, those magnitude 5s and magnitude 6s would have been a sign that larger earthquakes were possible. Inevitable, in fact, given enough time. The big one is coming, eventually. You ought to have been prepared. terror attacks behave in something of the same way. The Lockerbie bombing in Oklahoma City were the equivalent of magnitude 7 earthquakes. While destructive enough on their own, they also implied the potential for something much worse, something like the September 11th attacks, which might be thought of as a magnitude 8. It was not an outlier, but instead part of the broader mathematical pattern. Defining and measuring terrorism. To look at the statistics of terrorism, we first need to define exactly what it is. This can get a little tricky. Vladimir Lenin said that the purpose of terrorism is to terrorize. This is more insightful than it might seem. Terrorists are not purely seeking to maximize their body count. Instead, they want to maximize the amount of fear they inflict on a population so as to alter its behavior in some way. Death and destruction are just a means toward that end. You may kill people to achieve that, Rumsfeld told me, but that is not its purpose. Still, there is a wide variety of violent behavior throughout the world, and so academics have sought a somewhat more precise definition to distinguish terrorism from its counterparts. One definition, employed by a widely used database of terrorist incidents, requires that terrorist attacks must be intentional, that they must entail actual or threatened violence, and that they must be carried out by subnational actors, meaning not directly by sovereign governments themselves. The incidents, moreover, must be aimed at attaining a political, economic, social, or religious goal. And they must involve some element of intimidation or coercion, intended to induce fear in an audience beyond the immediate victims. The type of terrorism that most explicitly meets these criteria, and which is most familiar to us today, has relatively modern roots. The UCLA political scientist David C. Rappaport dates it to 1979, the year of the Iranian Revolution. He relates it to religious extremism, particularly among Islamist groups. This wave of terrorism is associated with a sharp rise in the number of attacks against Western countries and Western interests. From 1979 through 2000, the number of terror attacks against NATO countries rose almost threefold. Most of the incidents, however, produced few fatalities, if any. From the Iranian Revolution through September 10, 2001, there were more than 4,000 attempted or successful terror attacks in NATO countries. But more than half the death toll had been caused by just 7 of them. The 3 largest attacks, the Air India disaster, the Lockerbie bombing, and Oklahoma City, had accounted for more than 40% of the fatalities all by themselves. This type of pattern, a very small number of cases causing a very large proportion of the total impact, is characteristic of a power law distribution, the type of distribution that earthquakes obey. Clausette's insight was that terror attacks abide by a power law distribution as well. Suppose that we draw a graph plotting the frequency of terror attacks on one axis and their death tolls on the other. At first, this doesn't seem terribly useful. You'd clearly see the power-law relationship. The number of attacks decreases very steeply with their frequency. But the slope is so steep that it seems to obscure any meaningful signal. You'd see a large number of very small attacks, and a small number of very large ones, with seemingly little room in between. The September 11th attacks look like an outlier. However, as was the case for earthquakes, the data is easier to comprehend when we plot it on a logarithmic scale. More specifically, a double logarithmic scale in which both the vertical and the horizontal axes are logarithmic. It's important to emphasize that I've done nothing to this data other than make it easier to visualize. It's still the same underlying information. But what had once seemed chaotic and random is now revealed to be rather orderly. When plotted on a double logarithmic scale, the relationship between the frequency and the severity of terror attacks appears to be, more or less, a straight line. This is, in fact, a fundamental characteristic of power law relationships. When you plot them on a double logarithmic scale, the pattern that emerges is as straight as an arrow. Power laws have some important properties when it comes to making predictions about the scale of future risks. In particular, They imply that disasters much worse than what society has experienced in the recent past are entirely possible, if infrequent. For instance, the Terrorism Power Law predicts that a NATO country, not necessarily the United States, would experience a terror attack killing at least 100 people about 6 times over the 31-year period from 1979 through 2009. This is close to the actual figure. There were actually 7 such attacks during this period. Likewise, it implies that an attack that killed 1,000 people would occur about once every 22 years. And it suggests that something on the scale of September 11th, which killed almost 3,000 people, would occur about once every 40 years. It's not that much of an accomplishment, however, to describe history in statistical terms. Sure, it's possible for a statistical model to accommodate an event like September 11th, now that one has actually occurred. But what would Clausette's method have said about the possibility of such an attack before it happened? September 11th certainly did shift the probabilities somewhat, just as the number of very large earthquakes in recent years implies that they are somewhat more common than we might have thought previously. Nevertheless, even before it occurred, the power law method would have concluded that an attack on the scale of September 11th was a clear possibility. If the power law process is applied to data collected entirely before 9/11, everything from the beginning of the modern wave of terrorism in 1979 through September 10th, 2001, it implies that a September 11th scale attack would occur about once every 80 years in a NATO country, or roughly once in our lifetimes. This method does not tell us anything specific about exactly where and when the attack would occur. It is a long-term tendency, like the tendency toward earthquakes in California. And terror attacks, unlike earthquakes, can plausibly be prevented. This is an important qualification to Clausette's hypothesis. What this data does suggest is that an attack on the scale of September 11th should not have been unimaginable. The power law distribution demonstrates that events of a much larger scale than occurred in the past may plausibly occur in the future. Our lack of familiarity with them will be an especially poor guide to their likelihood. Magnitude 9 terrorism. But if the September 11th attacks were tantamount to a magnitude 8 earthquake, what about the potential for something larger still, the equivalent of a magnitude 9? Clausette's method gives us reason to believe that attacks that might kill tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people are a possibility to contemplate as well. The mechanism for such an attack is unpleasant, but easy enough to identify. It would most likely involve weapons of mass destruction, particularly nuclear weapons. The world, fortunately, hasn't had much experience with nuclear warfare. The atomic bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Japan in 1945, at the end of World War II, killed about 200,000 people. One estimate holds that an equally powerful weapon, detonated at one of New York City's major ports, would kill on the order of 250,000 civilians. But nuclear technology has evolved since then. A larger and more modern weapon, blown up over Midtown Manhattan, could kill as many as 1 million New Yorkers while incinerating hundreds of billions of dollars in real estate. Simultaneous attacks on New York, Washington, Chicago, and Los Angeles could kill on the order of 4 million Americans, in line with the stated goal of Osama bin Laden. These estimates reflect, probably, worst-case scenarios. Because such an attack could be hundreds of times worse than 9/11, however, the question of its likelihood has been the subject of intense debate in the national security community. One of the more pessimistic assessments comes from Graham Allison, a professor of political science at Harvard. Allison served in the administrations of both President Reagan and President Clinton, and his books and papers on the Cuban Missile Crisis have been cited thousands of times by other scholars. So when Allison has something to say, his peers listen. Allison came to a frightening conclusion in 2004. A nuclear terrorist attack on America in the decade ahead is more likely than not, he wrote. Allison qualified his forecast by saying it assumed we remained on the current path. A world in which there are dangerous terrorist groups, vulnerable nuclear materials at many places around the world, and a lack of focus on the problem from U.S. policymakers. We are more than a decade removed from the September 11th attacks. But when I spoke with Allison in 2010, he reaffirmed the gravity of threat he perceives. It's one that he takes quite literally.